Support for this episode is brought to you by Mrs. Myers. A delightfully clean home can make for a delightful start to the day. At Mrs. Myers, everything we make is inspired by the garden. With plant-derived ingredients, our cleaning products work like the dickens, leaving your home sparkly clean and your to-do list tackled in no time. So bring a little bit of the outside inside your four walls and bask in the wonder of a garden from the comfort of home. Mrs. Myers, rooted in goodness. Shop now at MrsMyers.com.
Boxing Show on the Grueling Truth Sports Network. The Old Time Boxing Show is brought to you, of course, by the Retired Boxers Foundation. If you want to find out more about the Retired Boxers Foundation, you can go to Facebook and look for the Retired Boxers Foundation. Also, you can find Alex Ramos on there, who can answer all your questions, does a lot of great work for them. I am your host for the Old Time Boxing Show, Mike Goodpaster. Right now, I want to welcome in the resident boxing historian for the Grueling Truth, Christopher Shelton. How you doing, Christopher?
Good, Mike. I'm glad to do this.
You sound tired today, Chris.
No, I'm actually okay. I've been up a while, so just rehashing all my notes and stuff.
All right, and today our topic is the life and career of Max Baer. Max was ranked by the Ring magazine as number 22 on the 100 greatest punchers of all time. He actually started his career out a little bit. I mean, you could say it was reminiscent of Mike Tyson because he's KO, 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 KO. I mean, he's knocking all these people out. He did have a draw with a guy by the name, or a disqualification loss against Jack McCarthy, but he went a couple years before he lost the fight. He lost a couple DQs, but at the start of his career, this guy looked like somebody that definitely was going to be a great fighter.
Yeah, really aggressive, you know, purely an offensive fighter. And it's just too bad, you know, these fights weren't filmed and placed on YouTube and stuff like that. So I get to read about them, but I'd like to see them.
Yeah.
And a lot of first-round knockouts.
Yeah, then you get August 28th, 1930, or August 25th, 1930, where he beats Frankie Campbell. And this was a huge fight in the San Francisco area. Both of these guys were big-time, up-and-coming fighters. This was supposed to be, I mean, a huge fight, which it was. The problem was Baer ended up beating Campbell rather bad. I know he catches Campbell on the ropes, I think, in the fifth round, and beats him. The referee did not stop the fight when he should have, Toby Irwin. And Baer ended up killing Campbell, and this really changed Max Baer.
Yeah, it also it stayed on him, his reputation, and years after his death, Cinderella Man, the movie and the book, really made Baer out to be a ruthless killer. I only get to read the report since I don't get to see the video, but apparently if there is anything dirty that happened in the fight, it was in the second round where it appeared that Campbell knocked Baer down, and Baer did go to the canvas. And then Campbell started walking to a neutral corner, and Baer motioned to the referee that it was a slip, and I gather the referee agreed it was a slip, and Campbell didn't know, and Baer rabbit punched him, hit him hard in the back of the head, and knocked him down. And then in the fifth round, that's when Baer was legitimately battering him around, and apparently Campbell may have been pinned against the ropes or was pinned in some way, or he wouldn't go down, and his head may have even hit the pole, the corner pole. He was hit so hard, eventually, by the time he finally went to the canvas and the referee stopped the fight, that the autopsy revealed that Baer had knocked his brain loose from its foundation. It was bouncing around in his skull when he died. Baer was arrested and charged with manslaughter, and probably the important part was really the second round, because that's the only thing where he might have done something illegal or even criminal. But the coroner ruled that punch to the back of the head had no effect. I don't know how the coroner would know that, but had no effect on what happened in his death, and that it was the fifth round blows that caused his death. So Baer was ultimately released.
Yeah, and I mean, There was, I think it was Tom Maloney, who overheard at the end of the second round in Campbell's corner that Campbell said that it sounded like that something was broke in his brain.
Yeah, and then as I said, the coroner ruled that his brain was knocked loose from its foundation. It's hard to believe. I think the coroner, I don't know if he was doing anything wrong or something, or just felt bad for the boxer. It's hard to believe that, especially what you're saying, that second round rabbit punch had no bearing on what happened to him. But that's the one that, if the later movie in the book want to portray him as a killer, it's that second round punch that you can hold against him. And as you said, though, Bear certainly took it hard. I think he lost four of his next six fights, and didn't appear to be the same fighter. Maybe never really was the same fighter again. It's hard to tell because we don't get to see those early rounds, those early bouts of his where he scored all those first round knockouts. Now, he eventually would obviously become champion, which we'll talk about, but I'm not sure if he was ever the same guy that he was before he fought Frankie Campbell.
Yeah, and from the newspaper reports I read, early the next morning, after the fight, Frankie experienced hemorrhaging of the eyes, leaks of blood down his spinal column. While he was hovering at the hospital, Max Baer actually went to see him. The reports I read said he had tears as big as golf balls falling down his face, visiting the stricken fighter's bedside. He held his wife's hand. The thing is this guy just... Anything you read about him or find out about him, he was a happy-go-lucky guy, and he's really not a guy, when you look at him, that you would think would even be a boxer.
Yeah, he's certainly, even as you see little pictures of him as a baby and a little boy, he has a real cherubic sort of boyish face, and then he's always smiling, and he's always in a cheerful mood, and the people around him said that, yeah, he was a little bit, odd and stuff, and he certainly always had a reputation as a playboy, but that he was a fun-loving guy, and he didn't appear mean-spirited to me in the ring, in at least the bouts that are filmed and are put out there. He's not a particularly dirty fighter or anything, but unfortunately, Ron Howard and Mike DeLisa, the writer, they managed to portray Max Baer in a way that was really nasty, as some kind of vicious killer for the sake of their cinema or book driving purposes.
Yeah, and then a couple of fights later, he fights Ernie Scaff, loses to him by unanimous decision. I think the AP had it 5-4-1 for Ernie. And this was the start of really a huge downfall in his career, as you talked about. He lost four of his next six fights. You look at it, he lost the guys that were good fighters. Tommy Lofgren was a great fighter, but he was a light heavyweight
champion.
Lost to Johnny Risco, who was a good fighter. Polino Yuzgadun, who I think that we mention in every show where we talk about heavyweights before 1950.
Tough Spanish
and
guy.
Then after that fight, he gets on a run. He comes back, he beats Risco, beats King Levinsky. Beats Ernie Schaff again, Tuffy Griffiths, who was a solid fighter. And then that set up what I think was the fight that really put him into the public conscience in June of 1933 against Max Schmeling. And the story here was Bear's trainer, her manager, was actually Jewish. He wore the Star of David during the fight. Of course, we know what was going on with Hitler in Germany at the time. And this was a hell of a fight. And Schmeling took a massive beating from Baer. I mean, Baer, to this point, this looked like the Baer that I think people heard about before the tragedy with Campbell. And he ends up, stopping Max Schmeling at 151, round 10. It was a 15-round scheduled fight. But this fight right here kind of made him an American hero.
Yeah, I made him a star. I just want to mention the two fights with Ernie Schaff just really quick. The first fight Schaff won. The second fight, it's important to mention it because of the Cinderella Man stuff, is that he won a decision, though he did knock out Schaff with about 2 seconds remaining, but Schaff was saved by the bell. And then following that fight, Schaff said that he had headaches, and then he fought Primo Carnera, and Primo Carnera killed him in the ring. And meanwhile, for the purposes of the Cinderella Man thing, they blamed Max Baer for it. So if you read the book, I don't know if the movie said this, they said Max Baer, the killer of two men in the ring.
Yeah, it's
so
like
he was blamed for killing Ernie Schaaf, even though that's really stretching it. And anyway, I thought that was worth mentioning. And then, yes, when he fought Max Schmeling, that did turn him into a star. He did become, he was 25% Jewish, which makes you Jewish, but he became more pronounced in showing his Jewish ethnicity by wearing this giant star on his shorts. And he gave Schmeling a really strong battering and became enough of a star that he was given his own movie with Myrna Loy, The Prize Fighter and the Lady. Got good reviews by the New York Times.
It's
a leading
really
man.
Bad
He's
movie,
not,
though, if you watch it.
I didn't get to watch the whole movie. I only got to watch parts of it. Is it a bad movie? Well, that's too bad. And then Primo Carnera is playing the heavyweight champion, and it's just sort of and then, of course, they were going to fight, but they hadn't fought at that time. So it's too bad it's a bad fight. But New York Times did give Max Baer good reviews.
Yeah, but this is the thing. I mean, back then, there wasn't much to choose from. So then you get 1934, June 14th, Max Baer fights Primo Carnera for the heavyweight title. Carnera outweighs him by almost 60 pounds. He's 263, I think, and a quarter. Max Baer was 209.5. Referee was Arthur Donovan. 52,268 was the paid attendance at the Madison Square Bowl in Long Island City, Queens, New York. Actually, going into the fight, Carnera was a slight betting favorite on the afternoon of the fight. But the time the boxers entered the ring, Baer was slightly favored. And this was a fight that, I mean, 11 times in 11 rounds is how many times
right.
he goes, is how many times Carnera goes down. I don't think, when you watch the film, there's no doubt that Carnera is not a very good boxer. But there's also
that's true.
No
that's
doubt
probably true.
That he has as much heart as he does size. I mean, he was a tough guy. He wasn't a great fighter, but he was a tough guy. And the thing is, I think I read where he spent a week or two in the hospital after this fight also.
Yeah, he did, and they got pictures of Baer visiting him in the hospital, and he was in the hospital for, I think you're right, a couple weeks. And Baer, you know, it's amazing that, you know, again, the courage of Baer to take on a guy this big, you know, heavyweight champion. I mean, I would think I'd be a little bit nervous, but Baer attacks Carnera throughout, and I'm not sure absolutely every knockdown is a knockdown. Sometimes a couple of them were like wrestling knockdowns, but they were legitimate hard punches that he was hitting Carnera, and Carnera just, you know, flop backwards and get back up. Yeah, it was a real battering, and it's officially labeled 11 knockdowns in 11 rounds. And it turned Max Baer, who was already a popular guy and a movie star, into the heavyweight champion in a very sort of dramatic way and helped pad that reputation of, wow, what a hard puncher that he could knock down this giant 6'6", 263-pound guy 11 times.
Yeah, and then you get to, as we talked about, the Cinderella man, James J. Braddock, June 13th, 1935, Madison Square Garden, paid attendance of 29,000. Baer actually goes into the fight as a 10-1 favorite. I don't think too many people give Braddock a shot. He'd beaten a couple fringe contenders coming into this fight. When you watch the fight, I mean, and I'm sure you did watch it, because I know the AP, the Associated Press, actually scored about 7-7-1 in rounds.
Well, you know, this thing is pretty close. I mean, it's first of all, Baer had almost a year to the date when he fought Carnera, and he was obviously enjoying the Hollywood lifestyle and partying and having fun and not training like he should. It's a listless bout. Baer scores the only really two hard punches, which is in the 7th round and the 11th round. Braddock never injures Baer in any way, but Baer is just so lethargic throughout. He's just not doing anything. Braddock is doing little. I mean, I'm glad that Ron Howard got to read this book and decided to make a movie based on the book, because I can't imagine watching this 15 rounds and saying, you know what, I think this would make a great movie. this is a boring, boring fight. And I'm not sure, I kind of understand, did Braddock really do enough to take it away from Max Baer? But then again, Max Baer did nothing except for those couple hard punches in those rounds and no follow-up.
Yeah, what I would see when I watch it is this, though. The rounds that Braddock won, he clearly won. The rounds that I give Baer are rounds that were probably questionable.
That could be absolutely that. I think Braddock at least was doing something and landing some combinations that weren't necessarily injuring Bear, but he was at least doing something. And Bear's a very strange fighter to watch. Now I get a chance to. He throws no jab. I've never seen a guy who just absolutely doesn't have a jab. He doesn't even attempt a jab. He simply uses his left for reach and distance and then winds up and tries to, you know, land his right. Another strange thing for Bear as he got to this point in his career with the Jewish star and his boxing shorts and stuff, I noticed it, and then finally I saw her announcer mentioned in a later fight, he keeps playing with his shorts. He's constantly, like, his shorts are too big for him, so he's constantly pulling and pulling on his shorts. So it's a really strange thing. He's pulling on his shorts more than he's throwing punches at Braddock. So I can understand, you know, the idea of, you know, did Braddock really do enough? Maybe he did, as you said. He clearly won the rounds that he won. He did. He was doing something, and Bear, if nothing else, except for I think of those two rounds, I'm not even sure that what other rounds to give Bear other than maybe calling some of these even. So it's not an unreasonable decision to give it to Braddock, but it's a disappointing way for Bear to lose his title, because after that he got in great shape again and was ready to fight, but it was too late.
Yeah, and when you look at Cinderella Man, the thing that really struck me the first time I ever saw Cinderella Man, I think it came out in like 2005 or something, 2006, whatever it was. But the thing that struck me was this. Number one, when they start portraying Max Bear as a mean guy, I know right there that's bull crap, even 15 years ago, just from all the boxing that I've seen and everything I'd read and seen about Max Bear. But the thing that really stood out to me was Ron Harrow's portrayal of the championship fight was the fact that the Star of David on the trunks of Max Bear is really small, where if you watch the actual film of the fight, the Star of David is huge. It takes up half of his trunks. And I thought, I think that that's where you really know that Ron Howard is trying to turn Max Bear into the bad guy for sure here. And I know every film needs a villain, but if it's a true story, you don't need to make a man a villain that was by no means a villain.
Right, I agree. I only watched part of the movie because I was so mad at the book. And in fact, in my younger days, I had a little bit of a temper. So if it was my book and I was unhappy with it, I'd actually throw it against the wall. I even set a David Halberstam book on fire. I was so mad at the facts and stuff.
Well, as long
anyway,
as you
I was,
set David Halberstam on fire, we'll be all right.
Well, he's dead, so he's safe from me. But in the bookstore is where I read this book. I read it in about 20, 25 minutes, and Mike DeLisa wrote it. And I was just furious. I was going to throw the book. And I go, it's not my book. You can't just throw somebody else's book. Because I was so mad at the portrayal of Bear. Calling him the killer of two men, I mean, that's absurd. Ultimately, you can give him his shots for the second round rabbit punch against Frankie Campbell. He was not the killer of two men. And if they portrayed him as a mean guy in the movie, I never saw anything like that. In fact, everybody said, now he might have been a little bit of eccentric. He probably was a womanizer and cheated on his wife, but that he was a pretty happy-go-lucky guy. And everything on film shows that. At least, you know, people like Jack Johnson, who's a fairly easygoing guy, there are moments you can see him in rage, you know, when he's in the ring. You never really see Schmeling in any sort of rage. The Frankie Campbell isn't on film, or at least I haven't seen it on film. But I've never seen him in fights act, you know, or hit below the belt or do anything, you know, really nasty. And then he liked to have fun and was a partier. There's just not a lot to suggest that he was getting into fights in Hollywood and stuff while he was partying. And yeah, if he's portrayed as a mean-spirited guy, that's unfair. The killer of two men, unfair. And if they lowered the star, the David star in the shorts, because again, I didn't see the movie enough to know that, that is another nasty thing to do. That's somehow Ron Howard doesn't want a Jewish villain or something, or he's trying to make his a non-Jewish person making some sort of statement by altering the shorts, and I don't understand what you're doing that you're going to lower that star or make it smaller. You're doing something that isn't right when you're changing the shorts themselves.
Yeah, and I think the book you read about James J. Braddock was the one written by Jeremy Shapp?
No, it was DeLisa. Mike DeLisa wrote it.
Okay,
that was the Cinderella Man, I think it was called.
Yeah. Okay, after that, you know, Bear, like we said, after the Campbell fight, he was never really the same. But after the Braddock fight, he takes off 3 months, and he comes back and he fights Joe Lewis. And the thing is, Lewis ended up being one of the pallbearers for the funeral with Jack Dempsey, because Jack Dempsey was one of the guys that guided Max Bear's career, especially after the Frankie Campbell fight. But Joe Louis gave him a hellacious beating, knocked him out in the fourth round at Yankee Stadium in the Bronx. That was a one-sided fight, and by now you can see that Max Baer really has no love to be doing this.
Well, he's going to have one more surge in him, but yeah, the Louis fights also, it reminds me, what about Montel Ron Harrod? Hey, why didn't you just make a movie about Joe Louis instead of Cinderella Man? Because it's amazing when you watch Joe Louis after watching Braddock and Baer for 15 rounds, and wow, this guy's throwing punches, this guy hits hard, this guy has terrific leverage. I mean, it's not that I forget how great Joe Louis is, but he looks even better after, you know, watching Braddock for 15 rounds, and then four rounds of Joe Louis, and being, man, this is the next heavyweight champion.
Yeah, but this is the thing. The movie's made because of the story behind Braddock
winning
it. Not that it was a great fight that he won it, even though Ron Howard took huge liberties on making that look like a great fight.
I'll say this, though, and you're that right, that Baer always hoped to get a title opportunity against Louis, and Louis didn't necessarily deny him, it just didn't work out, and Louis did appear to be friends. There's kind of a sweet interview by Lou Costello where he interviews Joe Louis.
Yeah, I watched that this morning.
Oh, you saw that?
Yeah.
Oh, it's kind of a sweet thing. And actually, what Schmeling does is interesting because he kisses Joe Louis a couple times. You don't always see a white man kiss a black man back then. And actually, there's quite a few pictures of Schmeling kissing various men, but not, I don't know, gay way. I mean, like an Italian sort of way, you know. But it was
I know what you mean.
There'd be nothing wrong with being gay, but he's not doing it that way. But it is an interesting way that, again, he's a real affectionate guy and a happy guy. Again, his family members are crushed that he's portrayed as this killer and mean guy because, again, this is a cheerful guy. And Joe Louis was his buddy, and Paul Baer, as you said, Baer just probably didn't hang in there long enough to get an opportunity to fight Louis again, because he's also losing by the end of his career. But he might have had another opportunity, and Louis didn't deny him, and Louis did dominate him easily in those four rounds.
But in that first fight, Baer did enter the fight against Louis with a broken right hand and a bone chip in his left wrist, and his manager, who we talked about before, Ansel Hoffman, pleaded with him to postpone the fight and see a specialist examine it. Baer was examined by an orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Healy, who told Baer that his left wrist would heal over time, but his right hand should be operated on before he fought again. But Baer decided to go ahead and fight Louis instead of having the operation.
Yeah, that all could be it also, since it was like 4 months after the Braddock fight, that would have meant it was only his second fight in about 16 months. And he once won a, you know, sort of a prolific fighter and stuff. And I think whatever his injuries and stuff, he may have been better off had he, you know, taken another fight in between or something and sort of, you know, tuned himself up. He doesn't look very good for that. It's a bad year for him.
It's going to be hard to look good against Joe Louis.
It's going to be hard to look good against Joe Louis, but as I said, one thing I thought was startling is just watching Joe Louis after 15 rounds of Braddock is, man, you're not facing Cinderella Man anymore. You're facing the guy that – you're facing Midnight. You're facing a guy who could really hit.
The thing that
leverage.
People may miss here is you talk about him landing two big right hands against Braddock, and I think one of them was really early in that fight, correct?
Well, I know that the 7th round and the 11th rounds were the rounds that I remember,
and then Braddock got a very good
8th round.
So what I mean, the one thing I will give him is this. He dominated Carneri, dominated Schmeling. Braddock was a fight where he didn't look himself. I mean, it's possible that maybe he breaks his hand in training before or breaks his hand during the fight, and that's why we don't see the activity, because the thing that stands out to me is – he was pretty much a guy that would just go in and swing if you watch him against Schmeling and Carnera. So the question is, why wouldn't he swing like that against Braddock? Maybe it was the hand.
Right, or Braddock maybe possibly kept him off balance, but you're right. If he had a hand problem, he would be more crippled than almost any other boxer because he only used one hand. He merely used his left for reach and distance. He never threw jabs, and only very end of his career did he even use his left as a punch. He really just used it to give himself some distance and then set up his right. So if he has a broken right hand, he's in real trouble because that's all he has. That's all he uses.
Yeah, and then he went on, as you said, he won 15, 20 fights in a row, something like that. But the thing I noticed about the fights that he won, there weren't too many against guys that were really good. I mean, you got a ton of guys here that are 16 and 19. 3-14, 1-2, 5-11, 12-0, 4-0, 9-7, 15-16, 16-27. Hell, he fought a guy by the name of Al Franco in 1936 who was actually making his pro debut. So when I look at this, I really don't see a need for Joe Lewis to ever give him a rematch. And then when you get to the first really tough fighter he fights after that is Tommy Farr, who was a tough guy from England, and he ended up losing on points to Farr. Then he lost a rematch, or let's see, he came back and he beat Farr in a rematch, though, and then lost to Ludnova by KO or TKO. But really, he was a guy that wasn't fighting much competition there. Christopher.
No, but I also think something was seriously wrong with his finances. He apparently, though, he said he spent money faster than he made it, because he all of a sudden, after again a year between Carnera and Braddock, and then, you know, 16 months, he only had those two fights. Then suddenly, in a space of 10 months, he fought 22 times. The most prolific moment at any time in his career, when he's really not the same kind of boxer. So I have to believe he either had a gambling debt, or he owed money to the government, or he had something going on where he was in debt and he had to pay off this debt. Because 22 fights in 10 months, when you really hadn't been fighting at all before that, you're right, he wasn't really facing the greatest competition, but something was going on with his finances.
Yeah, and the first loss to Farr was April 15th, 1937. After he lost the fight, his post-fight comment was, "I'm washed up. I'm going back to my ranch in Florida and retire." And then a month later, he's back fighting again. So I think there could be a lot to what you say there also. Would you look at him, though? Tommy Farr was a tough guy. I mean, he gave Joe Lewis a good fight. I think he went the distance with Joe Lewis.
Went the distance.
And it wasn't a bad fight. I've watched that one before.
No.
And then Bear comes back and beats Farr. And, I mean, he beat him relatively easy. The judges' scores were 13-2, 11-3-1, 9-5-1. And the winner was promised a title shot against Joe Lewis, provided Lewis got past Harry Thomas. Of course, we know that. You know, Joe Lewis was still the champion. But you never got that. And the thing was, Joe Lewis didn't floor Farr. You know, Braddock never knocked him off the feet. So this was really a good win for Bear.
Yeah, and one thing's for sure, he looks in terrific shape. And he was in terrific shape, if nothing else, because he's fighting so much. And, a couple times he'd gone 20 rounds in his career. He could get, when he wanted to, he could get in shape again. And he clearly got in shape. And part of that was he did want the opportunity to fight Lewis again. But, again, as I said, that he was fighting so prolifically, I think there was some sort of financial problem. But he was real popular when he fought two-ton Tony Galento. That was a really high-profile bout. Galento had knocked Joe Lewis down in the second round. He looks like Butterbean.
Butterbean, you know, what you think he was. Butterbean looks in better shape than Tony
Galento. Probably. Tony Galento had his own charm. You know, like everybody a bum.
He looked 9 months pregnant.
Yeah, I'm going to take on this bum, and I'm going to knock out this bum. And he talked like that, and he did sort of the George Foreman thing, where how did he train? He drank a lot of beer. Obviously, it doesn't seem like it's true, though. Again, he might just have a really oddball shape, because he doesn't ever look to be in shape. If Bear's boxing skills somewhat leave to desire, boy, Galento's leave nothing. He's just kind of throwing punches and stepping forward as he's doing it, sort of sloppily. And Bear did, you know, pretty handily stop him, and then Galento didn't come out for the eighth round.
Yeah, then we get to June 1st, 1939. Max Bear loses to Ludnova. Gets stopped in the 11th round because of a cut to his mouth. I know that there was a book written by Nate Fleischer, I think in 1942, which discussed this bout, where Fleischer said that Bear had sustained a mouth cut earlier in this fight. Profuse bleeding from the cut hampered Bear's breathing. Fleischer indicated in his evaluation of that fight that this was a competitive fight up until this stoppage. And the other thing here was, little known fact, that this was the first boxing match that was ever televised.
That I didn't know. I didn't know that. I will just throw out just his last before the Nova fight, which is his last fight, there's a fight against Pat Comiskey, and it's just a first
Yeah,
round
now,
knockout.
Hold on, hold on,
it's just fun to see Bear have
Chris,
that.
Chris, chill out. There's two fights against Nova. He fought Nova in June of 1939, and then the last fight of his career. So
right, and in the last fight of his career, he did score a fourth round knockdown. It was pretty one sided though with Nova. But if you say there's a breathing problem, I believe there was some sort of problem with his breathing. He is really fatigued throughout. In fact, he looks like he's intentionally ending the rounds right next to his corner, so that the minute the round ends, he just immediately plops on a stool. And he's doing that for round after round. He's completely, completely winded. So I did not know why he's so winded, but he did, and it's his last fight, but he was very, very fatigued throughout and dominated by Nova pretty easily, though he did score a fourth round quick knockdown.
Yeah, but after the first Nova loss, he comes back and he gets on a run again. He beats Tony Galento, which you just talked about, Pat Comiskey. Then he wraps his career up with the Lou Nova fight. After his career, though, I mean, he was acting. He was a popular guy.
Yeah, and he is a happy, again, he still stays sort of a happy-go-lucky guy, and he was able to make money, but again, probably spent. I don't know how much he left in his estate, but yeah, I don't want to mention the ending. I'll let you mention the ending, but he was pretty much happy-go-lucky the last day of his life, of his short life.
Well, and the other thing that was interesting that I found was after he beat Pat Comiskey, I think it was the second to last fight at Roosevelt Stadium in Jersey City in 1940, he was awarded a belt declaring himself the white heavyweight champion of the world.
Yeah, that's very bizarre. It's hard to know how serious that was, and that's a little unfortunate.
I don't think it was, because the fight was not promoted as being for the white heavyweight championship.
No. And I just, the only reason I brought it up, I just thought it's a first-round knockout by Bear, and maybe it gives you an idea what Bear was like early in his career or something, and it's just something fun that I thought the audience would like if they saw it on YouTube or something.
Yeah, and everything else I read about the white heavyweight champion thing was the belt was a publicity stunt dreamed up by the boxing promoters for Bear, who were trying to pressure promoter Mike Jacobs into giving the ex-world heavyweight champion a rematch with current champion Joe Louis. But, of course, he never did get the rematch, and if he would have, it probably wouldn't have went too well anyways.
Yeah, I agree. It probably wouldn't have gone too well. And I think that, again, Louis didn't deny him anything. It seemed like they were buddies. And then he's so dominated by Lou Nova that you could understand why it may not even be in Louis's interest to bat him around, though it wasn't really his ultimate decision. But it wasn't probably necessary that Schmeling get a rematch for the title.
Now, we go to
Bear.
I know. You keep getting them mixed up, by the way. But
a twin?
Yeah, it's like fourth or fifth time.
Really? Oh, my God.
I know. It's all right. Everybody knows who you're talking about. They're both named Max. Same damn thing. Then you get his acting career, which you talked a little bit about before, The Prize Fighter to the Lady, which I think was made in 1933. He was opposite of Myrna Loy, Walter Huston. It was an MGM movie. But the interesting thing there was, on March 29th of 1934, The Prize Fighter to the Lady was officially banned in Germany at the behest of Joseph Goebbels, who was Adolf Hitler, of course, Minister of Propaganda and Public Entertainment, even though it had received favorable reviews in local newspapers.
Yeah, Bear always said that it wasn't banned because I was Jewish. It was banned because I kicked Schmeling's ass, which probably maybe both reasons were why it was banned in Germany.
Yeah, it was probably both. But in the end, he ended up being in 20 movies, including Africa Screams with Abbott and Costello. Also appeared in vaudeville, had his own TV variety show. He appeared in Humphrey Bogart's final movie, The Harder They Fall, 1956, opposite of Mike Lane as Toro Marino. So when you look at his life, I mean, he lived a life that he only lived 50 years, but there's not too many people that did more with the life that they lived.
Yeah, you know, he's got legitimate acting credits, and I remember seeing him in this movie or that movie, these cheapy $1 movies that you could buy at one time, and so he built a legitimate resume, and a boxing career, and at least an acting career. It may not have been, I don't know if he's the greatest actor, but again, the New York Times liked him in his first movie, and he clearly at least could act. Unfortunately, we see someone like Joe Louis, you really want him to say, stick to boxing. He sounds so wooden when he speaks in the movies. While Schmeling seems much more natural as an actor.
Yeah, and then we talk about the
Schmeling.
death.
Bear. God damn it. God damn it.
Then we talk about Bear. Wednesday, November 18th, 1959, Bear actually refereed a nationally televised 10-round boxing match in Phoenix. Went out for cocktails after that. But on the 21st, Bear checked in at a Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel upon his arrival. Actually, it was November the 19th. Hotel employees said he looked fit but complained of a cold. As he was shaving the morning of November 21st, he experienced chest pains. He called the front desk and asked for a doctor. The desk clerk said a house doctor would be right up. A house doctor, he replied, "No, dummy, I need a people doctor." So he was funny even as he was dying. But a doctor gave Bear medicine, and a fire department rescue squad administered oxygen. His chest pains subsided, and he was showing signs of recovery when he was stricken with a second attack. Just a moment before, he was joking with the doctor, declaring he had come through two similar but lighter attacks earlier in Sacramento, California. Then he slumped on his left side, turned blue, and died within a matter of minutes. His last words reportedly were, "Oh God, here I go." Go ahead.
I was just going to say that, these days, you visit the doctor and they take numbers and they warn you if something's going on with your numbers and your heart and your cholesterol and stuff like that, but they really didn't do that in Bear's time. So he could be in really good shape, but if you might have a heart condition that needs tending to that you don't know about, and you get absolutely no warning. In fact, that's what I've been told. I've told it'll clamp on you like an artery closing, and the way you find out that you have a heart condition is you have a heart attack. And in his case, it was fatal. He was only 50 years old and the youngest heavyweight to die until Sonny Liston, who was 38.
Yeah, and his funeral was attended by more than 1,300 or 1,500 people. Of course, we already talked. Joe Louis and Jack Dempsey were among the pallbearers. I think I read Henry Armstrong was there also, made the front of the New York Times. So I think when we look back at Max Bear's career, the one thing that's really sad, and it's kind of like I did a show with Charles Learson, who was a writer for the New York Times, who wrote a book about Ty Cobb, The Terrible Beauty, which is a great book you can find on Amazon. But you had Al Stump, who made the movie Cobb, and wrote about Ty Cobb, and Al Stump was basically a drunk who got fired from almost every place he wrote for, but everything that he wrote about Cobb stuck, so people call Cobb a racist.
Great story, yeah.
They call him all of these things that he truly wasn't. I mean, you can look back and find an interview on YouTube that he gave in 1949 or 1950 when he thought it was disgusting the way that the black athletes were treated and the fact that they weren't allowed to play with him. And when you look at it, the same thing happens to Max Bear with Ron Howard in the Cinderella Man movie, because they make him look like something he's not, which is an animal just trying to kill people, when really he was the opposite, which is really, in turn, what made his career really drop off. So when people think of Max Bear, you're more likely to think of one of the worst men to be the lineal heavyweight champions. But this was a guy who, up until probably the James J. Braddock fight, at that point was kind of thought of like a Mike Tyson was up until 1988. He was a guy that dominated everybody and really put fear in the hearts of everybody that faced him.
Yeah, I say I really enjoyed that Stump story of Ty Cobb. Though I remember that it ended saying that there was only three people in baseball that showed, or three people in general that showed up to the funeral. Apparently, a lot of people went to Ty Cobb's funeral. That wasn't true, but at least with Ty Cobb, there are a lot of people that say, "What a son of a bitch he
no,
was,"
there
and stuff like
there
that.
There is not a lot of people to say that. There is
baseball
nobody
players
says that. No, there isn't. I mean,
yeah,
they said he was a son of a bitch because he played hard. I mean, the stories about him using his spike to slide into players was not true. I mean, the picture that was taken, I think it was when he played against the Indians, where you've got his cleat going into the guy's chest, the catcher. The catcher even said it wasn't a dirty play. I mean, he comes in to slide, and he's trying to knock the ball out because that's what guys did at the time. If you look at the only people you see that say anything bad about Cobb were people that said it after 1960 when they were interviewed and asked to say it. Because when you look at interviews, and Charles Learson, I mean, pulled up all kind of interviews from different newspapers with players, he could find almost nothing. I mean, people didn't like Ty Cobb because he was better than them. But there's not much saying Ty Cobb was dirty, because Ty Cobb, yeah, if he played today the way he played then, would be considered dirty. But
I meant to contrast the reputation of Cobb, but I won't even argue one way or the other about Cobb. I'll just say that there aren't a lot of people saying bad things about Max Baer, and I think it's really unfortunate for his family that this movie is so widespread and seen and portrays their kin in such an awful way and such an unfair way. Though I will, if I give Ron Howard any credit, again, I just didn't want to watch the movie. He probably just followed the book, and the book, you know, called him a killer of two men, and Ron Howard maybe, you know, just said, you know, I'm just following a book, and I don't really, you know, but I think you should care a little bit more, and certainly, again, what you said about the trunks and lowering, you know, shrinking the David Starr, that is a very strange decision, and now I really don't want to watch the movie, because I don't want to watch a movie that's untrue. So you said you still think it's a pretty good movie, but
this is my problem with the movie. I haven't done a lot of research on Braddock, so my problem with the movie is this. Yeah, it's a great movie. I loved Rudy when I originally saw it, but when I find out the way they portray Dan Devine and all the fake shit that was put into
that didn't actually happen.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, yeah, I don't like it as much now.
Can you imagine Joe Montana and all the players walking out of Dan Devine saying, we're not going to play if you don't let Rudy on the team or something?
It's just not true.
No, it's not true. No, that's what I mean. That's ridiculous.
Because Ara Parseghian told Dan Devine, you know, when he got the job, he said, hey, I told this joke that can't play football, he could play. Because the thing that stood out to me is when I wrote the article about the Rudy movie, was the fact that the only time I ever found Joe Montana interviewed about it and about carrying Rudy out the field, he was in tears laughing. Because it is true, but if you watch the film, if you watch the movie, you know, he makes a move, goes sacks the quarterback. In the real game, he's basically getting his ass blocked, and the quarterback happens to run by, and he reaches out and grabs onto him, and the quarterback runs him like 5 yards down the field before he tackles him. And then Joe Montana says, it was a joke we were carrying him off the field. He said, we carried him off because we thought it was funny as hell. And the problem is, like Ken Burns with Ty Cobb. Ken Burns in the baseball documentary, which was, 70% bullcrap anyways.
I thought so too.
And see, this is what I think Ron Howard did. I think Ron Howard did the same thing Ken Burns did. Ron Howard is a movie maker. He's not a researcher. All right?
Right.
Ken Burns is a documentary filmmaker, which should make you a researcher, but it isn't. He went with whatever the popular stories were about these players and ran with it. I think what Ron Howard saw was Ron Howard's probably not a boxing fan. If he is, he's not a huge boxing fan. I'm sure what Ron Howard knew was this. Max Baer killed this man in the ring, and then another man died after fighting him, so there's your bad guy. And the book
called him a killer of two men, and that's your bad guy. And then it makes it more dramatic that Braddock is facing this double murder. And it's unfortunate, because I have seen Bear's relatives who are in shock and sadness that this is what people think of him, and Bear can't defend himself. And I think you and I really try our best to call it. Sometimes we disagree on something, but nonetheless, we try to be fair. And if Baer were this bad guy, we would say so. If we thought he was a killer of two men, we would say so. If we thought he was the killer of one man, and certainly one man, he threw a rabbit punch in the second round.
The thing is, it's a boxing match. You both know the risk when you go in. I don't think Ray Mancini murdered Dooku Kim. I think he won, and then some bad things happened as a result of that win. But it's the same risk both fighters took going into the fight.
Right. And also, in Baer's defense, as far as the fifth round, he's throwing punches until the referee stops it. He has to throw punches until the referee stops it. It's the referee's job to jump in and stop it. And the coroner cleared him.
Yeah, what happens, Jerry Cooney and Ken Norton, if that referee lets Jerry Cooney throw one or two more punches?
Oh, absolutely. With maybe a lot of fights, or there were fights where the referee let him throw one or two punches they shouldn't.
Because he's sitting on it. Because to me,
he's helpless.
Seeing the fight against Frankie Campbell, the fight when I read about it that stood out into my mind was Cooney Norton, where Norton's caught on the ropes and he's not able to go down, and Cooney's just hitting him. And I mean, I thought the referee let that go too long, but if that referee lets one or two more punches go, Ken Norton probably doesn't come out of that.
No, absolutely. And as I said, you can't blame Bear for anything that happened in the fifth round. He has to throw punches until the referee stops it. You know, and the corner cleared him of any wrongdoing. And I guess it just sounds dramatic that the brain is separated from its foundations and such. You know, it's obviously, you know, Bear is hitting him really hard or, you know, and such. But again, he has to do it until the referee stops it.
Well, see, and I don't know what Frankie Campbell had done before that, but it could have been the fight before that could have started this in action. You don't know. Just like with the Ernie Gaff, maybe it was, you know, a punch that he got from Bear that started in motion, but we don't know that. And either way, when you look at Max Bear, he's not a guy that's trying to kill somebody.
Yeah, the Ernie Schaaf, he went to a plane of headaches after he fought Bear, but nonetheless, he stepped into the ring against Primo Carnera, and that is on film. And you're getting hit by a guy that's 6'6" plus, over 260 pounds, who's hitting you pretty hard. If you're getting hit, that has to do something with, you know, Schaaf dying. And it was just writing a book and telling a movie that somehow they blame Max Bear for it, you know, even though, I don't know, you're really stretching it. I mean, God, you already got him killing one guy. Now you got to have him kill two guys. It's just nasty. It's nasty to the family because the family is the one that pays the price for, you know, and Ron Howard just goes on and makes another movie. Now he's making some very good movies. And you say Cinderella Man is actually a very good movie, but I just couldn't bring myself to watch it. I was tempted to watch it.
My problem with the movie now is this. If he lied about Max Bear, what did he lie about with James J. Braddock?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, because I got mad at the book before I got to the ending of it, and I was already through it.
The Rudy movie, I was already mad at that because of the way they portrayed Dan Devine. But when I wrote the article about it, I start to find out, well, he didn't even have a brother, and his brother's girlfriend didn't exist, and, you know, the black guy in Rudy that lets him into the stadium, there was no black guy to let him into the stadium. He didn't even work on the grounds crew.
Well, Mike DeLisa says that, and I can't speak for the book. Again, I just didn't like the book. You know, I was unhappy with it. But that the movie was only meant to show 4 months of Max Bear's life, and it just happened to be the 4 months where he was, quote-unquote, an asshole, which I have no idea whether he was or he wasn't. I know he was partying pretty hard, and everything when you watch him fight. The Playboy Max Bear, so he had a reputation. But I don't know that he was a bad guy during those four months.
This is how I would disprove that. I did find an interview on YouTube with Max Bear before the fight, where he's talking about, if Braddock punches pretty well, if he hits me with right,
yeah, he's joking around.
Yeah,
he was joking around, but also he was saying, yeah, Braddock has a legitimate fight chance to beat me, and he was a good sport about losing, you know, to Braddock. And so I guess we've done our best to, if any of his relatives hear this interview, that we did our best to be fair, and that we both agree that the book and the movie suck. The movie made me really mad, and the movie sucked. The portrayal of Bear.
True.
Beyond that, I'm
going to write an article now, though, just to see how much of the Braddock stuff was true.
Yeah, you know, if I could bring myself to look at the book again, and I just can't. It disgusted me. I wonder how much is stretching it and how much is true
There's one thing. If everything's true about Braddock and they just tried to make Bear look bad, that's, I guess, better for the movie. I would still say it's a good movie because the Braddock story, if it's the way they said it is, and from everything I know about Braddock, it is fairly accurate, then yeah, I would still say it's an all right movie. But, I mean, unless, put it like this, if I tell somebody, you know, you ought to watch this movie, and they're not a big boxing fan, or they are, but they don't know a lot of history, I would say, yeah, it's a really good movie, you should watch it. But when you watch Max Bear, that stuff's not true.
Yeah, there's at least one thing that we both agree on, that Ron Howard is a very talented director, filmmaker.
I think he's a joke.
Well, I love Apollo 13, but
there's so many historical inaccuracies in there, it's not
probably true. Probably true. If he's going to play games with this movie where we know the arena, I imagine NASA people probably watch Apollo 13 and want to throw the TV at the wall.
Well, see,
he probably played a lot of games.
For some reason, it's some sickness I have that whenever I watch a movie that's supposed to be based on a true story, after I see the movie, I will immediately go research it to see if it was true or not. And I can tell you this, I've seen almost no movies that were even close to being historically accurate.
Well, that's probably true. When you
Maybe
know an area, I can't think of a.
the closest I can think of that was accurate was actually The Fighter, the Mickey
Where,
War or Mickey Ward movie.
right. Well, also, I mean, I really like Raging Bull, but it gives the impression he and Sugar Ray Robinson were more equals than they were.
It also
But
gives you the
anyway.
impression that he wasn't as bad a guy as he actually was.
Well, that I think they, I thought it comes
Oh yeah,
across
they
pretty
make him
bad
look
in the
like a
movie.
complete scumbag, but not nearly as bad
Right.
as what he really was.
Well, anyway, the one thing you didn't talk me out of is you didn't talk me out of seeing The Prizefighter and the Lady. I haven't seen it, but I'm still going to see
No,
that movie and
actually, I
give
mean,
it a
for a
shot.
movie in 1934 is probably all right. I'm just
It's
telling
better
you
than the
that,
Fred
yeah.
McMurray boxing movie. You gotta be.
I don't know. It's not as good as Matilda the Boxing Kangaroo. But, all right, Chris, we're going to wrap this up. We'll be back next Monday. Same bat time, same bat channel, 1 o'clock Eastern. Any idea what our topic's going to be?
I don't know. I guess we'll throw it off the. I was just thinking we were talking about the Tommy Morrison Razor Ruddock fight, and I thought we never really covered Razor Ruddock before, and then also just the idea of are fights supposed to be entertaining for the fans, or should you just try to fight to win and not care about the fans? And I thought Tommy Morrison and Razor Ruddock were fighting for the fans as well as putting on a good fight.
All right, we'll figure out a topic, and if you follow us on Twitter at The Grueling Truth, we'll let you know what that topic is through there. I want to thank everybody for listening to us again, and but
And
no, real quick, I did my phone or my headset cut out. I want to remind everybody that you can hear all of our shows on iHeart, iTunes, TuneIn, Spreaker. Anywhere you find sports podcast, you'll find The Grueling Truth. So for Christopher Shelton, I'm Mike Goodpasture. You've been listening to The Grueling Truth, where the legends speak.
This episode is sponsored by Schwann's.com. What are you having for dinner tonight? Good question. Schwann's Home Delivery has a solution for you. Stock up your freezer with high-quality frozen foods like premium meats and sides, delicious ready-made meals, ice cream, and more. No subscriptions, no memberships, just a friendly yellow truck that's been delivering food for almost 70 years. Listeners of this show get a special deal. Get 20% off your first order with code YUM20. Check out schwanns.com/yum for details.
Here's to the innovators, the makers, the doers, and the hustlers. With Facebook Elevate, you can grow your business, build your online presence, kickstart your career, or turn your passion of creating content into a reality. Facebook Elevate is a program that provides free digital marketing courses and one-on-one coaching from experts that can help you grow your business. Click the banner to start now. Facebook Elevate. On the rise together.